You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Maza Mengistu was born in Addis Ababa, but left her native Ethiopia in 1974 when she was 4 years old, after a communist revolution toppled Emperor Haile Selassie from power. She's returned to the war-torn land of her youth in her first novel, Beneath the Lion's Gaze, with the action beginning during the last days of Haile Selassie's six-decade rule. Ms. Mengistu was recently nominated for a Pushcart Prize, and she was named a new literary idol by New York Magazine. She visited our show in February, and we thought that we would re-air that conversation on this holiday weekend. The novel follows an Ethiopian family through an initial revolution and then the communist regime that followed, and I asked Maza Mengistu, do you feel lucky to have escaped from Ethiopia at that young age?
In some ways, yes. In other ways, I have very mixed feelings. Most of my family stayed there, and so they suffered through the revolution and the days that followed. And I always felt a sense of, I don't know if guilt is the right word, but I wished that many times I had been there with them.
In fact, there are a lot of people who have that kind of survivor's guilt, people who survived the Holocaust, for example, or who got out of Europe before their relatives died. The Marxist Military Confederation, was led mostly by Mengistu Haile Mariam. His name is somewhat similar to yours. Another Ethiopian emigre writer is named Dinar Mengistu. He was here for his novel, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears.
Yes, it's a common name, Mengistu.
And that is something like that, one variation or another?
Yes.
Why did your family stay in Ethiopia after you were sent abroad?
Part of this reason, I think they felt the sense that they needed to stay with my grandparents, with members of our family that were there. I have some uncles who at the time either had disappeared or one had died the year that I was sent here. And it was a really difficult decision, but
they'd had links to Haile Selassie's regime in one way or another, which would have made them vulnerable, wouldn't it?
And it did. It did. It was one of the, especially my grandfather. And that was one of the reasons my mother, I don't think, could have handled leaving if something more would have happened to other members of her family.
Mm-hmm. To some degree, you tell that story in this novel. This is not 100% autobiographical, but it does follow certain parts of the arc of your own experience, your family's experience.
Yes.
Where did you wind up going?
I ended up in Colorado, and I had never seen snow, had no sense of what that was like, and I landed in the middle of a storm in January, and I lived there for a while, and I lived in a home that had been taking in refugees. I was at that time the only Ethiopian there, but I was living with a group of Libyan refugees who were fleeing Gaddafi at the time, and I think they kind of took me under their wing, and they made it much easier to transition over, because listening to their stories, I realized that there was a lot of commonality with what was happening in Ethiopia.
Well, you were just 4 years old when you left. What memories do you have of wartime Ethiopia?
I was four when I left, and it's very surprising to me and also to my family how much I remember. I remember different scenes as if they're snapshots or just clips of a movie, of soldiers breaking in, asking me questions. No, I knew at that time I shouldn't answer, that I knew anything. People being taken away, playing outside and hearing the gunshots, things like that.
And you have a scene in the novel where the soldiers break into Hailu's home.
Yes, and that was
the same as they did with your grandfather's
house. Exactly,
exactly. So you've lived most of your life in the United States, in Brooklyn these days.
Yes.
When you first started writing fiction, did you know that you wanted to write about Ethiopia?
I had this story in the back of my head for a really long time, and I didn't know how fiction would actually do it justice. And I knew I wanted to be a fiction writer. I was not a historian. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a nonfiction writer necessarily.
Although I'm assuming you did a fair amount of research here.
I did so much research, yes. And so I had a very hard time approaching this story in fiction. But there was a day I was living in Los Angeles, and I opened up the newspaper, and there's this huge feature that's about the 25th anniversary of the fall of the military junta in Argentina and the dirty wars. And that feature seemed to talk about the individual people who were victimized by that. And there was a moment of, there was a sort of epiphany for me there that I recognized in their story part of my own story and part of Ethiopia's story. But what that journalist had done was humanize that tragedy and bring it down on a smaller scale. And that kind of gave me the impetus to try to consider fiction.
So you started writing short stories.
So I started writing short stories, and this story initially started with a short story.
But you've said that in some ways you were really frightened to write this novel.
Absolutely. Why? I was very frightened because of what the cost that I understood that the revolution took from the people of Ethiopia. I have so much respect for the an admiration for the bravery of so many involved. Just surviving was in itself an act. And I was talking to one of my mentors and Professor Breitenbach at New York University about this hesitation, and he told me sometimes fiction can tell a truth that history can't.
Well, he comes from South Africa,
yes.
And he had to leave to write about South Africa.
Yes.
The New York Times has compared your work to other English-language African writers who've written about civil wars in their countries. Nardin Farah, Chris Abani, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Hilan Habila. We can go on and on and on. Do you see yourself as a post-colonial writer?
That term is an interesting thing, because if you say post-colonial writer to an Ethiopian, Ethiopia has a very different history from other parts of Africa.
It's the only country that really, with the exception of 5 years of Italian occupation, never really submitted to colonialism.
Right, and I think lumping all African writers under that very vague label is, I think, a disservice to the unique and individual stories being told.
Ethiopia actually chased the Italians out in 1941. Of course,
yes.
They were already bogged down in Europe, so it was easier to do that. But many Americans of an earlier generation will remember when Haile Selassie went to the League of Nations and pleaded for the world's support when the Mussolini's forces were dropping bombs all over Ethiopia.
Right. Mustard gas.
Emperor Haile Selassie, who liked to be called the King of Kings, was a tyrant in his own right, wasn't he?
For many people, he was. Ethiopia was a country divided very deeply in terms of class and social stratifications. There was intense poverty. There was at one point, which he did work to eliminate, there was slavery there as well. Many people felt that he was a tyrant.
Well, he had he'd punished the people who'd stayed behind to fight the Italians when he ran off to England, which is something that some people never forgave him for, and there were secret police. But you sometimes write from his viewpoint. He's 82 years old in your book, near the end of his life, and your portrait can be seen as somewhat sympathetic.
Yes, it can. And I was looking at Haile Selassie in terms of this man who was a legend and a myth to so many, both in Ethiopia and outside of Ethiopia.
Because he's the black messiah to the Rastafarians.
To the Rastafarians. He was also, he represented so much to the world when the Italians were occupying Ethiopia. And I was looking at him in those terms, not so much a politicized figure, but this mythic man.
A man who becomes increasingly isolated. He only has his pet lions for company.
Yes.
Did he keep them as pets because the conquering lion of Judah is the symbol of the Egyptian monarchy?
He kept them because it was a symbol of his monarchy. He was called the conquering lion of Judah, and it seemed to represent his rule and the enigma of who he was.
And you've titled your book Beneath the Lion's Gaze, by the way. I'm talking with Maza Mengistu, author of this book, which has gotten rave reviews, deservedly, published, by the way, by Norton. The lions are almost characters in this book.
They're everywhere.
We hear them moaning.
They're everywhere, and they're everywhere in Addis Ababa if you go now, in terms of statues. Yes.
You describe the scene of Selassie's death after he's been ousted from power and locked up in prison, and you make the doctor's impoverished neighbor the trigger man. Does anyone know how he really died?
Well, in the book, he was actually in the book, the doctor's neighbor, who's Miki, was not the one that was the killer of Emperor Haile Selassie. In the book, I have a major, Gudu, who's in the book, kill him through suffocation. Nobody quite knows exactly how he died, but the general rumor was that he was suffocated or strangled.
With many revolutions, people support the revolution at first and then are horrified by what happens. That happened with the French Revolution. It happened for many people with the Iranian Revolution.
Yes.
I'm assuming it happened in this country because a lot of people left and went to England and Canada. Was that what happened with the overthrow of Selassie?
Yes, no one. There were many people who wanted the emperor out, but no one imagined the horror that would follow with the Derg regime, the bloodshed and the violence.
And then there was a drought.
And then there was the drought, the famine. Yes, the rains didn't come in northeastern Ethiopia in 1972, which led to the drought, and it led to the famine.
And then it led to the soldiers' mutiny in 1974?
Yes, the soldiers were complaining about poor living conditions. They were complaining about poor pay. The famine and the publicization of it exacerbated the situation.
What did people think the revolution would lead to initially?
I believe they felt that it would lead to a civil government, a new constitution, distribution of wealth, distribution of power in the government and of land, and it did not do all of that.
When the book opens, there's also the matter of Haile's wife dying of congestive heart failure. You complicated the situation here. A revolution wasn't enough, dying on the streets.
Right. No, people. Life went on, you know, in the midst of all that.
So then the communists came to, or this was a gradual thing, wasn't it?
Yes. It initially
was. Do you think it was because of the Cold War?
Part of it, I think, Mengistu was looking to wherever he could get the arms. That's where he was going to go. And the U.S., I believe, had an agreement with Emperor Haile Selassie to provide military support until 1978. So when the Derg came in, it was a little bit complicated. The U.S. was looking at all these human rights violations. They started slowing down on this aid. Russia stepped in.
Now, we're talking about this as though this is a book of history, but this is really a book about a family coping with a crisis situation. I'm
yes.
not going to go through all the plot lines, but to some degree, as we ascertained earlier, based on real family history, mm-hmm. to some degree, just based on what came to your mind, what you
yes.
imagined?
Yes. Hailu is the central character, and he's a doctor in a hospital, major hospital, Tukorambasa in Ethiopia. And during the course of the book, he'll be ordered by the military regime to take care of a torture victim.
And then there are the two sons.
Dawit and Jonas. And Dawit is this very radicalized student who was in the front lines of all the protests. And Jonas is a college professor who really wants to stay low, who wants to avoid all the chaos, and he hopes it just goes away. I also have Sophia and her two young boys who live in the slums of Ethiopia. And through them, I follow what happens to the poorest of the people in Addis.
Are there any plans to publish the novel in Ethiopia?
I hope so. I really hope so. And
how many people read English in Ethiopia?
Many people read English in Ethiopia. And I've received some notes from someone who will have a relative send them back the book. And they're, you know, people are enjoying it. I hope it does.
And your next book, you're going to return to Ethiopia as the location, or are you going to do something in the United States?
You know,
I'm assuming you are going to write another book or at least more short stories.
I am. And I feel like Ethiopia is so much a part of me that it'll be involved in some way or another.
Meanwhile, this book with wonderful reviews, deservedly, Beneath the Lion's Gaze, published by Norton. My great thanks to Mazen Mengistu for being on my show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Up next, Peter Hessler, the Beijing correspondent for The New Yorker, spent 7 years traveling through China. He describes how new highways and the cars they attract are changing the countryside. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.